So have you noticed that we're in the middle of a presidential election? Have you noticed that it's perhaps one of the least pleasant ones in memory, certainly in living memory? Have you noticed that people have been saying and doing some pretty extreme things? Well, that brings up, regardless of where you are in the political spectrum, it brings up a constitutional issue. Are there any sorts of limits, any limits at all, on what politicians can say during a presidential race? Is there anything a politician can do, conversely, when people say nasty things about that politician? For example, could we open up the libel laws to make it easier for candidates to sue? At least one candidate has suggested that we should do that. And that's why today we have our First Amendment guy, Doug McKechnie, and our topic is the First Amendment and the Donald. There are very few limits on what a politician can say in the United States, and in fact, very few limits on what any of us can say when it comes to protecting core political speech, the most highly protected category of speech that there is. Indeed, the Supreme Court has said that political speech must be, quote, uninhibited, robust, and wide open. Well, in this presidential election year, one candidate in particular seems to have accepted that invitation and actually tested the limits of it. Of course, I'm speaking of Donald Trump. And regardless of your political leanings, I think that we can all agree that he is, if not a unique candidate, certainly a rather unusual one. Recently, Mr. Trump has called for the opening up of libel laws, defamation laws, suggesting that perhaps he wants to sue some of his political opponents. That's a rather unusual thing for a presidential candidate to suggest. And today we're going to talk a little bit about that. And we're also going to talk about another big First Amendment issue that's raised by his rather, shall we say, aggressive supporters in some of his rather, unusual political rallies, where suggestions of violence are common. And the candidate himself has even said things that one might argue are unprotected incitements to violence, that is, things that aren't protected by the First Amendment, things for which Mr. Trump might even be arrested. With me today is Doug McKechnie, my buddy from the United States Air Force Academy, who's been on the show several times and who generally speaks about such issues, which is why I call him my First Amendment guy.
Stuart, my name is Doug McKechnie. I'm an associate professor
of
law.
Oh, Doug, stop. You've been on the show darn many times. I'm tired of it. But since you're at the Air Force Academy, you have to start with your standard disclaimer, don't you?
I do. My views are my own and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the United States Air Force, the Department of Defense, or the United States government.
Yada, yada, yada. Okay, now that we've gotten that out of the way, how you been?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
I'm not doing too bad at all. And so Colorado Air Force Academy, Law Department, and of course that leads us inevitably to Donald Trump.
Well, today we're going to be talking about some of the very interesting First Amendment issues that have been raised during the course of this election campaign.
Yes, and there have been quite a few of them, especially having to do with free speech, because if there's one thing that Donald Trump does, he speaks freely.
He does, and in speaking freely, sometimes he raises some First Amendment issues, whether intentionally or otherwise.
Exactly. Well, what's the first one we're going to talk about?
Well, one of the things that that may be of interest is Donald Trump's discussion of opening up libel laws, or opening up laws or changing laws that allow a person who thinks that they have been defamed in some way to sue the person who has articulated the defamation.
He sued people for that, hasn't he?
He has. He's got a pretty good record of either threatening lawsuits or, in fact, suing people. For example, in the mid-2000s, he sued, or perhaps in the 80s maybe it was, he sued a newspaper article that ran a discussion of a building that he was going to be building and called the building silly, and he sued the author of that article.
Wait a minute. We got to stop there. He sued an author of a newspaper article who called one of his development plans silly.
He did.
I'm going to guess he didn't win.
I know. In fact, the suit was dismissed. But nevertheless, he does have a history of either threatening or, in fact, suing. And more recently, and perhaps more interestingly for our discussion today, as a presidential candidate, he has suggested, as as recently as February of 2015, he has suggested that he would be interested in opening up the libel laws, as he calls it, opening up the libel laws, to make them easier for someone in his position to sue for alleged defamation.
Yeah, that's an interesting phrase, to open up the libel laws. But before we talk about what he might mean by that, or speculate as to what he might mean by that, let's talk a little bit. Let's do a little bit of a primer here. First of all, libel is a type of a tort, and a tort, of course, is the law of personal injury, and it's a type of what we call defamation. And why don't you explain what defamation is and what the difference is between libel and slander? And we'll start with that, and then we'll talk about how the Constitution impacts that, and then we'll come back to Donald.
Sure. So libel laws protect a person from having something written about them that is essentially, in modern times, is essentially untrue and puts them in an unfavorable light in a way that would harm their reputation.
Right. Whereas slander is the same thing, but only in spoken words.
Exactly.
And both of them are a variety of defamation, because to defame somebody is to in some way put them in disrepute.
Exactly, and in a way that would harm their reputation and then maybe even ultimately have some sort of economic or other harm.
Exactly. The example I will use with my students typically is if one of them were to say that Professor Harris likes to torture little kittens with a fork. And I saw him doing that the other day, laughing maniacally as he tortured this poor little kitty with a fork. That's perhaps humorous because it's such an outrageous example, but if in fact somebody were to say something like that, and if further it was something that was believed by a third party, that would tend to make that third party, that other person on the street, think much less of me, I hope. And that's hurtful in the first instance, because it's not nice to walk down the street and have people think ill of you. So it could cause emotional trauma to me. But also those people would be much less willing to do business with me. For example, maybe somebody at the law school would hear about that and decide they wanted to fire me, or they wouldn't want to lease an apartment to me, or they wouldn't want to let me in their store, or maybe I'd get kicked out of a club or a church or something. So you see that reputation, harming reputation, can cause direct emotional damage, but it can also cause a whole host of other damages, many of which are rather economic in nature.
That's true. The difference, perhaps, when Donald Trump talks about it, is that there is a different standard in our law.
Oh, you're getting way ahead of us now. You're getting way ahead of us now, because that's the constitutional stuff, and we'll get to that in a second. So let's just be clear. The tort, the idea is that simply by speaking, or by writing down that speech, the first being slander, spoken, and the second being libel, written, a person can harm another person. And the person who is harmed, the person about whom the speech is made, of and concerning that person, can then sue in court for the damage that's done to that person's reputation. That tort's been around forever. It's taken a bunch of different forms, and in English law it was a little bit different. There's even been a criminal aspect to it in certain circumstances. So we're not going to go into all of that. We're simply going to say that's been around forever. But at least as of about 1964, the United States Supreme Court started putting some limits on it, didn't it?
They did, and to even back up maybe a little before the 1960s decision that the Supreme mm-hmm. Court made, I think it's important for people to understand that in the context of defamation and libel, the monarchy in England way back in the 17th and 18th century, they were concerned, the monarchy was concerned about libel and defamation directed at the government and directed at the king. And so the monarchy actually had laws that made it a crime to slander or publish libelous things about the monarchy,
whether or not it was true.
In fact, today we have truth as a defense for defamation. That's right. But in the 17th and 18th century, truth was no defense at all. In fact, truth could be an aggravating factor, because the idea behind what they called seditious libel laws was that you didn't want to sow unrest with regard to either the government or even the Church of England.
Right. Yeah. So there were lots of limits on speech, especially speech directed at powerful entities like the king or the church, some of which could even be criminal. And obviously those sorts of things were very problematic. But as the law of tort has evolved in the United States, as you say, truth is a defense. So generally speaking, the tort of libel or defamation more broadly today only penalizes speech that is untrue.
Correct.
That's a fair statement. So that's just more or less the law of tort, as it has of defamation, that specific tort, as it's evolved in the United States. But then, in 1964, great big watershed moment. What happened then?
Well, in the 1960s, the Supreme Court decided that it was going to sort of bring the tort of defamation or libel into the realm of constitutional protection, mm-hmm. or part of the tort, and particularly with regard to the First Amendment and free speech, because obviously libel and defamation and slander are all forms of communication and expression. So there is some form of or relation to communicating an idea that has First Amendment implications.
Mm-hmm. Right. The First Amendment, says Congress shall make no law infringing freedom of speech or of the press. And if you read that very broadly, arguably, libel laws, at least as they affect the press and more broadly, everybody, might very well violate the First Amendment. It was quite possible that the court could have declared that the tort itself was completely unconstitutional, or alternately, on the other end of the spectrum, they could have said, oh, no, this tort's been around since before 1791 when the First Amendment was adopted. So they could have said, no, history and tradition tell us exactly the opposite. But they actually sort of went in the middle of the spectrum, didn't they? They left the tort in place in 1964, but they modified it to at least provide some protection for free speech, at least in the context of cases like the one they were facing. And of course, we've been talking around it, but the case in question is New York Times versus Sullivan. What was that case about?
Well, in that case, there was a gentleman who was the commissioner of public affairs in Montgomery, Alabama, and part of his responsibilities as the commissioner of public affairs was to supervise the police department. At the same time he was the commissioner, there were protests going on in Alabama, and particularly in Montgomery, Alabama, and other parts of the South, and these protests were related to the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some clergymen, Southern clergymen, and others who ran an advertisement in the New York Times. And essentially the advertisement suggested that there were African-American students and civil rights demonstrators in the South that were being subjected to violence. Although they were engaging in nonviolent activity, they were being expelled from school, and the police, the advertisement suggested that the police in Montgomery, Alabama, were using shotguns and tear gas and starving students, and they were generally engaging in intimidation and sort of a wave of terror.
Mm-hmm.
And right. So this gentleman, who was the commissioner of public affairs, saw this newspaper advertisement or this article in the New York Times, and he sued the New York Times and these clergy members and alleged that they had engaged in defamation.
Right. Sullivan was the commissioner. And the New York Times, one of the clergymen, was a very famous fellow most of us have heard of, Martin Luther King Jr. So this was a public official using the law of defamation to penalize Martin Luther King and other civil rights leaders and what's arguably the major newspaper in the United States in an attempt to silence them for speech they'd engaged in.
That's true. And what was interesting about the lawsuit and the actual advertisement and the language in the advertisement, Mr. Sullivan's name did not appear in the advertisement. And so,
yeah.
So there was actually no direct allegation that Mr. Sullivan had engaged in any kind of violent activity. The jury just connected the dots between the allegations about the police in Montgomery, Alabama, and his role as the commissioner of public affairs.
I dare say that if Sullivan had not actually brought the lawsuit, that nobody ever would have connected him to the alleged defamation.
That's probably true. Although the jury was quite sympathetic to Mr. Sullivan and gave him an award of $500,000, which for 1960s terms, that's about $4 million today.
That's a pile of money, and it was affirmed all the way up in the Alabama courts because, of course, tort law is a matter of state law. And so that's a garden variety personal injury case, and it goes all the way up, and it looks like the New York Times and the Reverend King and some other civil rights leaders are going to be on the hook for a whole lot of money. And let's just pause and think about that now. You've got the government, through the judge and through the law, ordering now the New York Times and these ministers and these other civil rights leaders to pay a pile of money to someone who they didn't even mention in their advertisement, who's a public official. Now, what is that going to do to free speech and freedom of the press, especially with regard to matters of enormous public concern like civil rights, if that were allowed to stand?
The reality is, for the New York Times and particularly for the civil rights leaders, it's going to have a particularly chilling effect. I mean, I think that what would happen is people would be very gun-shy about ever criticizing or suggesting that public officials had engaged in any kind of conduct that was impermissible or otherwise should be rejected.
Exactly. And think about the videos. You can still see them on YouTube today. All those videos you see of fire hoses and dogs being loosed upon civil rights protesters in the South. The people engaging in that behavior did not like the news coverage they were getting, especially perhaps the television coverage, because of course it was that press coverage of these terrible abuses in the South that helped build a consensus that something had to change. And so the people in the South, the officials who are engaging in this racist conduct, wanted to silence the press. This was a very political use of the law of defamation.
And that was really what the court had to struggle with. The court had to try to figure out, you know, where within the context of the Constitution and free speech is this, is protection of speech going to link up with, or how is it going to affect the need and the desire of society to protect the reputation of individuals? And so the court really is struggling with, can there be a cause of action, or can someone file a lawsuit for libel when that person is a public official and is being criticized in his or her official capacity?
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with my buddy Doug McKechnie, the First Amendment guy, all about the First Amendment and Donald Trump. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, then we'll come back and we'll speak some more with Doug. Stick around.
And worry my pet, you just talk, talk too much.
Well, Doug Smith, the exalted grand poobah of the Center for the Constitution, the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at Montpelier, how are you today, sir?
I'm doing great, thanks.
Tremendous. Do you have a quiz for us?
I do. I absolutely have a quiz. This is going to be a kind of a fun one.
Unlike most of them?
I think they're all fun, but I think this one is, it's fun.
Particularly fun. Tremendous. Do we have a fun person on the line?
Hi.
Are you fun? Whoever you are. Who are you?
My name is Lauren, and I'm from Jacksonville, Florida.
Hello to everybody in Jacksonville. What part of Jacksonville are you from originally, Lauren?
I'm actually from the Fleming Island area, a little bit outside, so you may be more familiar.
But Fleming Island is my old stomping grounds. With the other Professor Harris and I, also known as my wife, practiced law down in Green Cove Springs and in Orange Park for much of the 1990s.
Very familiar with that area.
Indeed. We probably drove past each other on Highway 17 on more than one occasion.
I'm sure we did.
Well, that's an exciting connection. All right. Doug, do you have a really good, tough quiz question for this Floridian?
I don't want to interrupt y'all.
Oh, I'm sorry. We're having a good time here. Come on now. Okay. I thought you said you were fun.
I do. I have a question. Okay, here
I'm
it comes.
I'm having fun.
I'm going to read the question and give you four choices.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Okay.
I'm ready.
Here we go. Today, we have a president of the United States of America. But what title could the convention delegates have chosen? Would it be A, Grand Meister? B, His Delicacy. C, His Highness the President of the United States of America and Protector of Their Liberties. Or D, Supreme Leader of the Revolution.
These were, just to clarify, these were proposals.
These were proposals.
Okay, or at least one of them was a proposal.
Yes, exactly. So today we have a President of the United States, but proposed at the convention, what could we have ended up with?
Okay.
Right. So
these
are actual proposals.
Which one of these?
I guess in theory they all could have been.
They all could have been, but which one was an actual proposal?
Are you a lawyer?
Yes, I am.
I can figure
that out. I just want to be specific here.
So this was a title for what became the President of the United States, a title that was presented at the convention, 1787, that we could have ended up with? Was it Grand Meister? A. B. His Delicacy. C. His Highness, the President of the United States of America and Protector of Their Liberties. Or D. Supreme Leader of the Revolution.
Lauren, any ideas?
I don't like A or B.
Okay.
I think I'm going to go with C.
And what was C again?
His Highness, the President of the United States of America and Protector of Their Liberties.
Now, that's a very lengthy Why are you centered on that one?
I'm centered on that one just kind of based on, you know, maybe coming over from the English roots. You know, the first two don't sound at all tied in, but the last one does have my attention as well since, you know, they, you know, trying to break off, you know, from the English rule, so maybe that could be too, but, you know, maybe it's the length. That's why I chose it.
Okay, so you're choosing based on length here, but you didn't like the Grand Maester? Are you not a Game of Thrones fan?
I actually haven't watched it. I know.
Okay, well then they have Grand Maesters in that one, but what about my personal favorite, His Delicacy?
It seemed, I feel like they would want the president to have a more powerful, strong name, and that just doesn't sound like that would cut it.
Doug, I can't get her off C.
That's a shame. I thought she was going to go with B, His Delicacy.
But?
In fact, it is C, His Highness, the President of the United States of America and Protector of Their Liberties.
Well done, Lauren. Well done indeed. You got it exactly right. And I think probably for the right reasons, because that is the most British sounding of them, isn't it?
Yeah. So the Supreme Leader of the Revolution.
Yeah. What about that one?
That would have been an interest, and you might have guessed.
Right.
Because
it was Revolution, yeah.
And the President of the United States was the Supreme Leader. George Washington was the first president. But in fact, Supreme Leader of the Revolution is the title that they give the Shah of Iran.
Oh, boy.
So you are correct. It was C, His Highness, the President of the United States of America and Protector of Their Liberties. But in the end, fortunately, President of the United States stuck, and that means business cards are smaller than they could be.
Much, much smaller indeed. Well, Lauren, thank you very much. You win, and therefore we're going to send you a pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier along with a YWC t-shirt. All you need to do is send us your t-shirt size and your mailing address to ywc@montpelier.org, and we'll have that stuff in the mail to you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for playing, and thank you, Doug.
You bet. It's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Doug McKechnie of the Law Department at the United States Air Force Academy. And Doug and I are talking all about Donald Trump and how he seems to be pushing the boundaries of what is protected speech under the First Amendment. And in order to get to what Donald has done and whether it's protected, we've had to go back and do a little bit of spade work. And we were talking before the break about perhaps the most important case in this area of constitutional law, something called New York Times versus Sullivan. It was a case where a fellow named Sullivan down in Alabama sued the New York Times and a number of civil rights leaders, including Martin Luther King, who had taken an ad out in the Times claiming that that ad defamed Mr. Sullivan. Mr. Sullivan won all the way up through the Alabama courts. He won a big pile of money, about $4 million in current dollars. And then the case was appealed all the way to the United States Supreme Court. The legal issue was the status of the tort of defamation, which penalizes people merely for speaking. Is that consistent with the First Amendment, which prevents the government from penalizing speech? The court had to do something, and it came up with an interesting solution.
They did really sort of split it down the middle. They said, you know, we're still going to let this tort continue to exist. We're even going to let public officials sue for defamation in the right circumstances. But here's the circumstance. We're going to make it really hard. We're going to say that if a public official sues anybody for defamation, that public official is going to have to prove either that the speaker, the person who allegedly defamed the public official, knew that what he said was false, or acted with reckless disregard of the truth. So the way I like to say it, and just in sort of common language, is that the speaker, the person who allegedly defamed the public official, either knew or should have known that what he was saying was untrue.
And this, in articulating this standard, the court really creates a new standard for constitutional purposes with regard to libel law. And this is probably one of the highest burdens that we have in the Constitution and in the free speech context. It is very, very difficult burden for people in the public realm, public officials and other public figures to meet this burden is very difficult.
That's extraordinary, isn't it? In fact, a lawyer would have to be a really remarkable lawyer to win a case like that, don't you think?
Yeah, he or she would have to be a pretty darn good lawyer.
Do you know anybody who's actually won that case? You know, a public official suing against a newspaper?
I don't.
You do, Doug. You know, because
I'm guessing I'm talking to him, Stuart.
You're talking to me, and you're talking. Well, my wife and I actually sued on behalf of a public official in Florida 20 years ago, who had been libeled by a newspaper. But without going into details and war stories and self-laudatory comments, I'll simply say that the case was a very strong one, and we were actually able to prove that the newspaper not only should have known that what it was printing was false, but it actually did know that some of the things it printed were false.
And that's a compliment to your legal skills, because it is a very, very high burden, probably one of the highest ones we have in the law.
Well, I'll be very, very gracious, and I'll accept your compliment. And I'll note an interesting correlation here, too, or an interesting coincidence. We actually settled that case for exactly the amount that was awarded New York Times versus Sullivan. We settled that case for $500,000. And we actually collected it. I'm looking at a copy of the check. It's in a frame on my wall right now. But, of course, a $500,000 check in 1998, I think that was the year. No, it was actually 2000. We filed in 98. It was not worth quite as much as it had been in 1964. That's a very, very tough case, and I just happen to know how tough it is and how rare those cases are because I've actually litigated one. Okay, now that's the standard. So, basically, again, if a public official we're skipping over a lot of detail, or somebody who we call a public figure like Donald Trump, who certainly has put himself out into in front of people on television and the media, such people are judged by the same standards through a whole host of other cases that followed on New York Times versus Sullivan. And of course, he might eventually be a public official. He could be elected president, and at which point he'd be not just a public figure, but a public official. If Donald Trump wants to sue you or me or Joe on the street for having defamed him in some fashion, he's going to have to prove that we either knew or should have known that what we said was false.
That's true. And the only way that he'd really be able to change that law, although he articulates the desire to change the law and he suggests that he would do it if he was elected president, the only way he would really be able to do that is with a constitutional amendment or putting judges on the Supreme Court who would be willing to overturn New York Times versus Sullivan.
Exactly. So loosening up the libel laws is not something that can be lightly done, and certainly not something that any president can unilaterally do.
That's right. And I think, you know, one of the reasons that there is some concern when people, whether it's Donald Trump or otherwise, when people talk about loosening up libel laws is because our country values the robust debate that happens, particularly in the context of public officials and public figures. And the reality is, you know, this is a high burden for them to meet. And so falsities will enter the public debate. But the Supreme Court, in trying to figure out where the free speech clause impacts libel law, decided that sometimes falsity entering the public debate is something that we should tolerate so that people don't feel as though they can't engage in the discussion that's happening.
I'm glad you added that, Doug, because that was another aspect of Sullivan that is often overlooked, is that there were some small, somewhat insignificant falsehoods in that newspaper advertisement all the way back there in 1964. And the court looked at them and said, so what? You know, what was the phrase they used either in that case or subsequent cases that public debate has to be wide open and robust?
Mm-hmm.
And it is. I mean, if Donald Trump were to sue you or me for making a false statement, even if it were false, if it were something really minor, if it were something that were incidental, the court would look at it and say, come on, you can't be suing McKechnie or Harris over making statements like this, because if you do that, and if we give you money for it, that's really going to inhibit them from saying anything about Donald Trump in the future. And especially if Donald Trump is president, we don't want to inhibit people from criticizing him.
That's right, and it really harkens back to our rejection of those sort of 18th century English laws that that the king would use to put people in jail for defaming him, and we rejected that in the First Amendment.
Oh my gosh, you used the phrase Donald Trump and King in the same paragraph. That's no matter where you are on the political spectrum, that's a frightening concept, isn't it? I mean, that's really what it boils down to. I mean, in the most common sense terms I can use, the most common terms I can use, you don't want the President of the United States, you don't want anybody involved in the political process to be able to shut down their opponents by suing or even by threatening to sue. Because if the law is changed to make these lawsuits more viable, then those threats will be taken seriously, and it will just shut down political debate.
That's right, and the result is part of living in a democracy, and in a democracy that values free speech, is that we have to tolerate sometimes things that are said about public officials and public figures that are just plain wacky and that are just plain untrue. But that's part of living in a society that values that open and robust discussion of public issues.
Well, you know that Barack Obama is a Muslim and he was born in Kenya. Actually, I think he's an alien from Mars and he was sent here to subjugate us all. I'm saying that on the radio right now, and I defy President Obama to sue me over those things. I know that they're false, but I'm obviously saying them, and this is another aspect of the discussion, in a satirical fashion. There's just a lot of deference given to discussions about public officials. That's why you don't see presidents suing people over defamation, even though outrageous things are said about them all the time.
Stuart, I wouldn't expect to get the lawsuit from President Obama anytime soon.
You don't think so? Would you represent me?
I will.
Thank you very kindly. You know, because he really is from Mars. I really think so. Okay. All right. Now, here's a nuance. Now, we've been sort of beaten up on Donald Trump's suggestion that he wants to loosen the laws. We've pointed out that he really can't. We've pointed out the danger of allowing him to sue as aggressively in the political context as he has in the pre-political public context he's done in the past. We've done all those things. But here's the strange thing, Doug. You sent me a whole email full of quotes that you and your research assistant had gathered on Donald Trump's discussions about these things, and I noticed that even as he was calling to, quote-unquote, loosen up the libel laws, the standard he was suggesting was actually pretty close to the current one. He would then say something like, people shouldn't be able to tell lies about me that they know are untrue without some consequence. And I'm thinking, well, you really don't need to loosen up the libel laws to sue somebody over that.
That's right. If it's the Supreme Court did retain this ability for public officials and public figures to sue, if what was said about them is demonstrably false and the person knew it was false. And so his suggestion about how he would change the laws is really not that far afield of what the laws actually are.
So maybe what Donald Trump is doing here is twofold. First of all, he doesn't realize what the standard is now. Maybe he doesn't really understand New York Times versus Sullivan and that you don't need to change the law in order to sue somebody over a knowing false statement. Number two, however, though, he seems to be suggesting that he's going to be willing as president or as a presidential candidate to very aggressively sue and threaten to sue people. And I think that's the troubling thing. That's the troubling thing because we don't like the idea of our president or even a presidential candidate threatening to sue political opponents, even if it wouldn't require a change in the applicable legal standard.
That's right. I think that even the threat alone would potentially have the possibility of chilling speech and making people concerned about engaging in the debate about the people who are going to lead us.
I think it would. I mean, whether Donald Trump has $8 billion or $1 billion or even only a few hundred million dollars, that's still a lot of money. He's going to be a rich guy no matter how you slice or dice it. And a rich, powerful fellow threatening a lawsuit against you is a daunting thing. And it would tend to chill speech.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm in the midst of a really, really interesting discussion with my buddy Doug McKechnie of the U.S. Air Force Academy, all about Donald Trump and the First Amendment. After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and then we'll come back and talk some more about the Donald.
Oh, I get slandered.
When later reflecting on the character of the framers of the Constitution, Madison expressed his admiration that there was never an assembly of men who were more pure in their motives or more steadfast in their aim of devising a constitution that would best secure the permanent liberty and happiness of their country. But when the Constitutional Convention was nearly finished with the work, Madison was deeply disappointed with the result. He confessed to Jefferson that he believed the Constitution would neither effectually answer its national objects nor prevent the local mischiefs which everywhere excite disgusts against the state governments. Nonetheless, he believed it was of paramount importance that it be adopted. If the present moment be lost, he said, it is hard to say what may be our fate. And he worked tirelessly for ratification in spite of his personal disappointment, showing true commitment to the public good over his own private interests. With your Madison Minute, I'm Jen Patia Howell.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to finish our discussion with Doug McKechnie all about the Donald and the First Amendment. Before the break, we were talking about Donald Trump's call to, quote-unquote, open up the libel laws and whether this suggested that maybe he's going to sue people for criticizing him during the presidential campaign or maybe even once he becomes president, if that occurs. Now we're going to shift our focus a little bit, and we're going to talk about whether maybe Donald Trump has gone beyond the protections of the First Amendment, perhaps by inciting violence at some of his rallies. And this discussion necessarily involves some pretty unpleasant language that might not be appropriate for younger ears.
What are some of the other issues?
So one of the other things that he has been alleged to have been sort of crossing the line with is incitement to violence. There have been.
Yes. Let's talk a little bit about that. Incitement to violence. What is incitement to violence?
So incitement to violence, or some of the people who have alleged that he's engaged in incitement to violence, is the encouragement by a speaker for others to do something unlawful, and in particular something violent perhaps, or even really incitement to any lawless activity.
Right. And over the years, especially in the World War I years, when people were making lots of anti-war speeches and anti-draft speeches, you had the police coming in to a rally and arresting the speaker, suggesting that what the speaker was saying had somehow incited people to disobey the law. And in fact, there were several cases involving even notably the socialist presidential candidate, Eugene Debs. Wasn't that Eugene Debs?
Yeah. It was.
Yeah. He was arguing against the draft. And they would say, oh, you're encouraging young men to break the law by resisting the draft.
Yeah, there was the Espionage Act of 1917 made it a crime to interfere with the World War I, the effort in World War I, or to interfere with military recruitment. And Eugene Debs was put in jail for violating the Espionage Act, and he actually ran for president while he was in jail.
In the election of 1920, and he got several million votes, didn't he?
He did.
That's hilarious. Can you imagine? But think about that. Think about that for just a moment. He's a third-party candidate, and even with millions of votes, he's not going to win. I mean, everybody knows that. But think about a third-party candidate today. What's the Libertarian candidate's name? Gary Johnson is out there. People have been talking about him because there's a lot of dissatisfaction with main party candidates this year. And so you hear about Gary Johnson. Well, what if Gary Johnson made a speech? Maybe it's an anti-war speech or an anti-war on terrorism speech or something of that sort. And the police just arrested Gary Johnson, said you're trying to incite people to break the law. They stick him in prison, and he's still running his political campaign from prison. And several million people vote for him. That's what we're talking about happening back in 1920.
It is. There was a significant amount of people who were interested in the socialist movement and even some of the anarchists movement and opposed World War I, and that was exactly what the Espionage Act was attempting to do, was to criminalize any effort to encourage people to not cooperate with the war effort.
Right. Okay. And over the ensuing decades, even though the Supreme Court kept announcing very protective tests for allegations of incitement, they really didn't start enforcing those standards until they got to about 1969 in the Brandenburg case. And could you tell us a little bit about what the current standard is for incitement to illegal activity?
Sure. The government now, as of 1969 and up till today, the government can only criminalize the advocacy of the use of force or the advocacy of some other lawless action if the advocacy, if the speaker who's advocating for the lawlessness is directing people or inciting them to produce the lawlessness imminently. Right now, right away. That's right. And what the speaker is saying is likely to actually incite people to engage in lawlessness.
And the speaker intends these things.
That's right.
So you have to show the speaker intends and is likely to induce people to immediately commit a lawless act. And those three things, the intent, the likelihood, and the immediacy, make it almost impossible to lawfully for the police to come in and jail somebody for inciting illegal conduct.
That's right.
So in other words, we're protecting a lot more speech as of 1969 and up till today than we did previously.
We did. This is oftentimes people think of or they hear that the previous test, which was called the clear and present danger test, and a lot of people
think
that.
Yeah, famous phrase. Yeah.
It is, and a lot of people think that that's really the applicable First Amendment interpretation with regard to incitement to imminent lawlessness. But that was essentially overruled or overturned or sort of thrown out by the court with this new, much, much more speech protective test.
Exactly right. Okay, so let's give an example. If I were to get up on stage and I was giving a speech and I said something along the lines of, I think somebody should go and shoot President Obama. That's a pretty nasty comment, and that's not a good example because that might actually come down to be a true threat, which is another area of law. How about if I say, I think that everybody should go out and should stop paying their taxes? There you are. That's not going to be incitement, even though refusing to pay taxes is a crime. Why? Because it's not clear that I intend for people to actually start doing that. Maybe I'm just engaging in hyperbole. And moreover, it's not likely that a lot of people are going to stop paying their taxes just because I said I think they should. And certainly whatever failure to pay taxes is not going to happen right that minute. It's not going to be imminent. So if they arrested me for saying I don't think anybody should pay taxes, it's not going to hold up. I'm going to be protected by the First Amendment for saying that very political speech.
And I think the reason the court made that decision in 1969 and in follow-on cases, really I think what the court was trying to protect is a word you used earlier, hyperbole,
right.
And words that are modifiers and words that are exaggeration. And the court in cases since the Brandenburg case has said, you know, advocates, people who are advocating for change, social change or otherwise, really need to be able to talk to their audience and get them sort of fired up. And sometimes that language is going to be spontaneous. It's going to be emotional.
Right.
But we have to protect that sort of speech.
And it even can be violent speech. I'll give another example. Let's say I'm a Nazi. I'm up there with my big swastika and I say something. This is really objectionable and I'm not really saying it. But if I'm a Nazi and I say, I think we should kill all the Jews. Okay, that's a pretty violent statement. It's a pretty objectionable statement. But do I intend that people actually do that? Even if I do intend it, is it likely that people are going to go out and start killing Jews? And finally, is it imminent? Is it going to happen right that minute? Probably not. So even if Nazis get up and make speeches like that, probably it's going to be protected under the First Amendment. But contrast that with this. I'm a Nazi again. I'm standing up there, and I point at somebody who is wearing a dark hat. Maybe he's a Hasidic Jew. And I say, there's one of those Jews. Go kill him. And the crowd actually starts moving toward him. Now, that's probably going to finally we find something that qualifies as incitement. Because I'm a Nazi. I intend for it to happen. It's likely that that poor fellow is going to get bonked over the head in just a moment. And it's going to happen that minute. It's imminent. That's the level of incitement that is the police can actually arrest me for. That's not protected by the First Amendment. Would you agree?
I agree. I mean, and I think that if we even want to think back to our discussion a moment ago about New York versus New York Times versus Sullivan, this is again the Supreme Court really pushing back and saying we need to have a very protective approach with regard to speech, and we want to make as much speech protected as possible. And so those protections are, as you mentioned, the imminent nature of the language, the intent of the speaker, how likely it is to happen. All of these things need to be met before someone can be essentially arrested for criminal speech that's inciting others to lawlessness.
Okay, so that's our standard. We finally come up with an example. Now back to Donald Trump. What has he said, and does his speech actually cross the line from being protected hyperbole, political speech, to actually crossing a line to where he committed the crime of inciting speech and he can be arrested for it?
Well, there have been various things that people have talked about potentially being incitement to lawlessness or incitement to violence. He's said things most recently about Hillary Clinton and being able to pick judges, federal judges, and once a president is picking federal judges, there's not much you can do about it. Although he said perhaps Second Amendment people may be able to do something about it.
This is a remarkable example. And in fact, let's think of the whole context. You've got the Donald Trump saying that maybe there's a Second Amendment solution. I'm paraphrasing there, but it was something like that. Maybe the Second Amendment people have a solution if Hillary Clinton picks judges that are going to overturn cases they don't like. Many people saw that as a veiled threat or a suggestion to these quote-unquote Second Amendment people that they might actually go out and do this. So maybe there's some sense that he's inciting people or encouraging people to engage in such behavior. And it's doubly concerning because there have been several press reports where people at the rallies have started a chant, which is extremely objectionable, and I'll say it here, we'll probably have to bleep out part of it. They'll be there saying, kill the bitch, kill the bitch. And they're referring, of course, to Hillary Clinton. That is getting awfully close, isn't it?
Well, I think this is the kind of language, the comment about Second Amendment people or Second Amendment solutions. I think that's exactly the kind of language that the Supreme Court was intending to protect when it made its decision in the Brandenburg case and made this burden on the government to criminalize speech that is incitement. I think that's exactly the language it was trying to protect, is this, the language that sounds like it's encouraging people to engage in some sort of violence or some sort of criminal activity. But really, I'm sure Donald Trump was getting caught up in the moment. He was using language that was colorful and certainly emotional. But do I think that he was intending that Hillary Clinton or trying to encourage people to injure Hillary Clinton? Probably not. And even if he was, how imminent was that to happen? Very, very unlikely that it was going to happen imminently.
Exactly. I mean, I agree with you completely. As objectionable as that entire scenario is, and certainly much of the language that's being used is, that Trump himself said he was being sarcastic. That he didn't intend to incite anybody or threaten anybody. He said himself specifically, or excuse me, as you pointed out, there's no imminent likelihood that somebody at one of those rallies is or listening on the television is going to go out and immediately engage in that kind of conduct. And so it doesn't meet any of the standards. And so, yeah, it's protected. I agree with you. But now we come to – oh, go, please.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think some of the language that might have come a little closer to the line that the court created is some of the language that he used when he was talking about throwing protesters out of his
– Yes. Yes, I agree with you completely. I think this is where we get the closest. Let's talk about that. What happened at some of his rallies?
Sure. At some of his rallies, he had talked about removing protesters. People would stand up at his rallies and protest and hold up signs or chant things. And he would – encourage the crowd to remove the protesters, and he would say things, again paraphrasing, he would say things about how he would like to punch the protesters in the face, or that if the protesters got injured on their way out as they were being escorted by the people in the crowd, if they got injured, that he would pay the legal bill to defend the people that injured the protesters. And so I think that's
awfully close, isn't it? He's at a rally, okay, and there are protesters. And especially after the first time, after he sees what happens, and he knows that people are going to act on what he says, and he knows that some of his supporters have actually gone out and punched some of the protesters in the rallies. And he's saying things like that. Let's go through the factors again. Does he intend that they be injured? One could infer that from the fact that he knows that there have been people injured at his rallies and have been punched and kicked at his rallies. Is there a likelihood of someone following his advice? Again, maybe so. And is it imminent? Yes, the protesters are right there. This is not like talking about Hillary Clinton, who might be 1,000 miles away. There's someone he might even be pointing at right there. This is awfully close to my example about the Nazi inciting people to bash the Jew over the head.
I think I would go back again to the New York Times versus Sullivan discussion, mm-hmm. and that incorporation or the use of the word knowledge and intent, and really what we're getting to is what was in the speaker's mind, or in the New York Times versus Sullivan context, in the writer's mind, the person who's the media person, what was in their mind when they made the statements. And by incorporating a requirement of intent or knowledge, whether it's with regard to falsity or whether it's with regard to intent to actually bring about lawless action, I think that this would fail that test, because it is incredibly difficult in the law, and probably one of the most difficult things in the law to prove is someone's intent. And the court, you know, it was not a mistake that the court required intent, because it knew that it's a very difficult burden to meet. And so, you know, I think one of the interesting things about Donald Trump and perhaps people like him is that the way he could defend the situations or the speech that we had just talked about is simply by him getting up and saying, look, I say really crazy things sometimes, and of course I don't mean them. I'm just a sarcastic guy who gets caught up in the moment, and of course I would never mean for someone to get truly injured. That's just the way I talk. And if the jury was shown many of the sort of zany things that he has said, they might actually believe that he's just sort of a person who shoots from the hip and says kind of wacky things, and, you know, he never really intends for anyone to get hurt.
So it would go to the intent element, because I think the other elements might be there, that there's a likelihood of illegal conduct, because we've seen it. We've seen assaults occur, and those things are imminent. So I think you're right. I think that basically it's the zaniness defense that would go to the intent element that might actually keep Donald Trump out of jail or defend him in a lawsuit.
Yes, I agree.
Okay, so you're going to take that case? If Donald Trump gets sued, you're going to go defend Donald Trump?
I'm not sure he'll be calling me, Stuart. I mean, you know what? I'll give him your card. I think you're probably the guy to represent him.
Well, I'd be very happy to, but I charge a very, very large retainer. But that's okay, because he's very, very rich. Well, Doug McKechnie of the United States Air Force Academy, this has been a really fun conversation. You always bring a lot to the table here. We appreciate the primer on the First Amendment and the law of defamation and your discussion of the Donald. Do you want to close with your disclaimer again?
Sure thing, Stuart. Thanks for inviting me on. I appreciate it. But of course, I have to let you know that my views are my own and don't necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the United States Air Force, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.
Thanks, Doug.
Thanks, Stuart.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to my First Amendment guy, Doug McKechnie, for coming on in and talking about some somewhat disturbing and unpleasant things today. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. Our Madison Minute is by Jen Patia Howell of the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harrison. Remember, you are a part of the American experiment.